darn hot. It's too darn hot.
Welcome to summer. Here's a pretty accurate forecast. It's likely to be hot in most parts of the country, but the actual air temperature isn't exactly an accurate gauge of how the heat is affecting humans. A primer on the heat index as jet streaming gets underway.
Fill the cup with my baby tonight, but I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
Around the upper Midwest, you might hear someone ask, hot enough for ya? For many people, when the air temperature and relative humidity combine at a certain level, the answer is, yep, it's definitely uncomfortable or even dangerous. I'm Kathy Werzer. This is Jet Streaming for another week. Along with me, the one and the only Mark Seely from the University of Minnesota and Mr. Paul Huttner, Minnesota Public Radio meteorologist extraordinaire. Mark and Paul, how are you two?
Just fine, Kathy. Thank you.
Doing great, Kathy, and staying cool today. It's nice.
It is very nice. Well, it's already been in the 90s several times in our home state of Minnesota. A little bit unusual for this time of year, Mark.
Yes, in fact, we've had several days above 90 here across the southern part of the state. Although we haven't set too many records, our temperatures for the month as a whole are tracking warmer than normal around the region.
Well, we want to wade into the meteorological considerations when talking about the heat index. And joining us for this is Ken Kunkel with the Illinois Water Survey. Ken is also the former director of the Midwest Climate Center based in Champaign, Illinois. Ken, welcome to Jet Streaming.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
You know, for the layperson, describe the formula for the heat index.
Oh, I don't think I'd want to describe the formula, but
a little tough.
But I can describe the factors that go into it. As you said, the temperature is not the only factor that affects human comfort during periods of hot weather. There's really three other factors that become important. I think people all realize these factors. If there's a lot of humidity in the air, people feel very uncomfortable, they feel sticky, and the reason they feel that way is because the humidity restricts the amount or the rate at which sweat evaporates from your skin, and that's the primary mechanism that the body has for cooling down, is through sweat and evaporation of that sweat. If the air is very humid, that evaporation occurs at a slower rate, and so you don't cool as fast. And that's the primary factor, but there are two other factors that are important, and people also are very aware of these. If you stand out in the sun, in the direct sunlight, that also affects your comfort when you're receiving the direct rays of the sun. And the other factor is the wind, that if you have some ventilation, most of the time that makes you feel cooler also.
You know, how long have we had the heat index? Obviously, when you watch TV, some meteorologists will include the heat index, others do not. How long has it been in existence in terms of a use for forecasting?
Well, that's a real good question. I really don't know if there were some earlier formulae that were used for that, but the ones that I've used for doing research, it's sometimes called the apparent temperature, goes back to the late 1970s. A couple papers were written at that time by someone who tried to quantify the effects of these meteorological factors on human comfort. So let's say kind of a modern heat index goes back to that time frame.
Okay.
Say, Ken, I know you've studied and published research regarding heat index climatology in the U.S., and I can't help but bring up the topic. In the climate sciences in recent years, there's been a lot of discussion about heat waves, that is, periods of high heat index values, being governed more frequently by high dew point values, in other words, abundant water vapor in the atmosphere. Did you find that to be the case in your research that you've done in the Midwest?
Yes. There's certainly a tendency for high dew points to be more prevalent in recent decades than was the case perhaps in the middle or the early part of the 20th century. And that is one of the major factors for the effects of recent heat waves on the human population. And probably I don't know, the one case that comes to mind, being here in Illinois, really the most notable heat wave of the last 15 years is the Chicago heat wave of 1995, when more than 700 people died. And that heat wave was really, in terms of human impacts, was caused by very, very high dew point temperatures. Typical dew point temperatures in the summertime in Illinois and Minnesota would be the same. Our 60s would be very typical. Nice cool days would have dew points maybe in the 50s. When you really have a very humid, sticky situation, dew points will rise into the 70s. In that particular heat wave event in Chicago, dew points got up to 80 degrees or even a little higher than that. That's almost unheard of, really anywhere in the U.S. 80 degrees is a very, very uncommon level for the dew point temperature. And if you look at that particular heat wave in Chicago, the heat index reached levels of around 120. So it felt like 120 degrees during that event. It's really, in some ways, not surprising that there were big impacts because of that.
Ken, Paul Huttner here, yes. And like you, I was in Chicago in 95. I know you guys are in Champaign there, just a little bit south, working and covering that heat wave. And it really kind of snuck up on people. It got hot, and of course people knew it was hot, and then suddenly bodies started showing up at the Cook County Morgue, and it got hotter. And this, for a solid week, temperatures were either in the high 90s, peaked on 106 on July 13th. And one of the things that they observed was that the real killer were these nighttime minimum temperatures. They stayed in the 80s for much of that week, and people just did not have a chance to cool off at night. In addition to the heat during the day, how important of a factor is that physiologically to the body to have a cooling period during a hot stretch of weather like this?
Well, I believe it has to be very important. And in Chicago, it was exacerbated by some social issues, people feeling like they couldn't open their windows even at night because of fear of crime and so on. And so they're apartments became like little ovens because of the very hot nighttime temperatures that didn't allow buildings and people to cool down.
How much, when you have values like this, when you have the heat and humidity combined with a high heat index, what helps to really cool someone down? A little fan blowing around hot air doesn't seem to really do much of anything, does it?
Well, no. And in fact, you know, I talked about wind being a factor in your perception of heat. If the temperature is too high, it actually becomes a negative factor. And that threshold is about 95. If the temperature is above 95, it really doesn't do any good to have additional ventilation. In fact, it can be a negative. Of course, you know, the standard steps that one is instructed to take, or, you know, if you can find an air-conditioning area, go to that. But if you don't have that, I think you need to slow down, get out of the sun. You know, we talked about the sun being an important factor. You know, and drink plenty of water so your body doesn't become dehydrated.
Say, Ken, this question's come up in my years over and over again, and I wondered if you've had it addressed to you. When the National Weather Service issues a heat watch or heat advisory, of course, it's based on this heat index value, but in perception, it seems to me that that's a conservative estimate, that when we put that number out there and say it's going to be 105 heat index or 110 heat index today, that that's under the specified conditions that you earlier described. But, you know, for those people, especially city dwellers who are maybe out in the environment exposed to the direct rays of the sun, maybe we're talking about roofers, construction workers, highway workers, etc., they could actually be exposed to conditions even more amplified than that.
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, the estimate for what direct sunlight adds to your sense of the temperature is about 10 to 15 degrees. So you can add another, let's say, 10 degrees to that 105 to 110, and that's what somebody in the direct sunlight will be feeling like. So it is quite an important additional factor to account for.
Say, Paul and Ken, since you were both in Illinois in 1995, can you paint a picture for folks who are tuning in here in terms of what that was like? You know, just the, you talked about Paul, the human factor, obviously, over at the morgue, but what did it feel like? What was that like?
It was relentless. That's the best way to describe it. I mean, it got hot during the day. It did not cool off at night. The dew point, as Ken said, we're in the lower 80s, and then things started to break down. Now, 49,000 households without power at one point, no air conditioning there. And after about 48 hours of continuous exposure to heat, you know, bodies begin to fail. And then just the shocking sights of the Chicago morgue. I remember covering live news for one of the hospitals downtown, and folks just piling in there as the emergency rooms became overcrowded. It was like a bad movie. But, you know, the good side of that is that the city of Chicago, after the event, really took this by the horns. And I was part of some discussions with a heat action plan there. And since then, they've established an emergency plan for heat. They have cooling centers. They are very active in the media to get the word out, and they have transport to get elderly people, people that are particularly susceptible to this kind of heat, to these cooling centers. So they've definitely improved some things after that tragedy in 95.
Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that the interesting thing about that was it wasn't a very long heat wave, but it was long enough, and it was so intense that no one expected what happened. The 700 deaths is something that really sticks in my mind to this day, seeing those bodies and hearing the reports. Certainly, in terms of actually experiencing the heat itself, it was just completely oppressive. You go outside and it would be just the feeling like this hot blanket on top of you.
You know, because you're a researcher, Ken, what did you take away from that incident and then others that you've seen past 1995 as a climatologist?
Well, you know, I'd follow Paul's comments. What was really gratifying was to see the steps that the city took to prepare for the next heat wave. And they worked closely with the National Weather Service and with various other organizations to make sure something like that wouldn't happen again. There was another fairly intense heat wave in 1999, not quite as intense as 1995, and all of these plans were in action at that time. They did have some deaths, perhaps 100 or so during that intense event, but nothing like what happened in 95.
Yes, another dimension to this, Ken, is I know, having worked for over 30 years in Minnesota, that our livestock producers have adjusted their care of animals based on those experiences, notably 1995 and 1999 as well. They're far more careful in terms of watering, in terms of building ventilation, and a number of other things to help protect and keep those animals out of danger as well.
Yeah, that's right. That's something that was another big impact of the 95 event was a large number of deaths in cattle herds throughout the Midwest.
You know, a final question here, Ken, and it's this, I guess. When you start looking at research into heat-related incidents and that kind of thing, is there anything that you're looking at or other researchers are looking at when it comes to an increase in heat and heat-related type illnesses?
Well, we are certainly considering the potential impacts of global warming on that and the additional threat that might pose in the future. So a lot of the research I'm working on at the present time is actually looking ahead 2, 3, 4, 5 decades or even more and trying to understand what might happen in the future, whether we will, most models project warmer temperatures. Will we also expect to see higher levels of humidity and then even higher levels of the heat index causing real danger to our citizens?
You know, I'm wondering, Mark, because of what Ken just said about high levels of humidity, you and I have talked about this here on the air, about with farmers growing more corn, say for ethanol, mm-hmm. how might that play into the high dew point type levels in the upper Midwest especially?
Well, there is a working hypothesis out there. Ken might be able to elaborate a little more on this, but that landscape feedbacks, especially regarding the intensification and the genetic manipulation of American agriculture, may have led to a transpiration stream, that is a release from the surface of a very amplified water vapor signal in midsummer.
I love when you talk scientific, don't you?
But I don't know that that's a widely accepted hypothesis. Ken, what do you think of that hypothesis?
Well, I don't know if it's a big enough effect to have a large influence on the climate system, but you know, you're right in pointing out that there's been changes in agronomic practices. They put a lot more plants out today than they did two or three decades ago, and that increases the evaporation rates from crop canopies, and it may have some effect. It's a little bit hard to know whether that's an important effect or not, though.
Hmm. Interesting discussion. Ken, I really appreciate your time here. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleased to be part of your discussion.
Great to have you on, Ken. Have a good summer.
Oh, same to you.
Thanks, Ken.
Okay, Paul.
Ken Kunkel is with the Illinois Water Survey, and of course, he was also the former director of the Midwest Climate Center based in Champaign, Illinois. Our discussion, gentlemen, leads us nicely into a listener question. Mark Seeley, this person asks, notice how well this all works out. I love this. What has been the highest heat index in Minnesota's climate record? And how does this compare to some of the most extreme heat index values worldwide?
Well, Ken already mentioned this year in our discussion earlier, but July 30th, 1999 produced the highest heat index ever measured in Minnesota. Down at Red Wing on the Mississippi River there, they had a temperature of 97, a dew point of 84, and an afternoon heat index of 125, which indeed for our region is extremely high. Now, looking around the world, Kathy, countries over around the Arabian Peninsula are generally the areas that report the highest dew points and the highest heat index values. And according to an article that appeared in WeatherWise magazine back in 1991, a station near the Red Sea had an air temperature of 100, a dew point of 91, and a heat index of 152. Now, that's even beyond the range of a sauna that I would want to even sit in for 5 or 10 minutes. I don't think I would want to put up with that for very long at all.
Is that instant sweat, Paul, when you walk out, do you think? I don't know.
That's off the charts. That is off the charts. And, you know, I say this sort of in jest, all this talk of heat getting me kind of hot under the collar. But one of the things that I do and that works, I think, in prolonged heat is to take a cool shower. As cool as you can get the water, cool your skin temperature down. Give your body some help. I know it works for me, and you know, that's my little bit of sage weather advice there today.
You're a little personal there, Paul Huttner.
Yeah, too much information.
Well, actually, I think it's really interesting to talk about all this because I think some folks seriously don't when they hear about summertime heat and when some of the meteorologists start talking about the heat index, I don't think they really get it at this point.
They call it the silent killer. Because heat sneaks up on people. It's not banging on your door. It's not loud like a thunderstorm. It's not a big wind. It just kind of creeps up on you. And one of the things that they have learned is that the effects of heat are cumulative. You can get overheated one day, and if you don't cool off the next day and do it again, you're in big trouble. And there's nobody there telling you to cool off. And you know, the other thing is it can affect your judgment once you get overheated. So those are some of the things that you have to keep an eye on when it gets hot like that.
Excellent advice, Paul. And I think we're coming into the time of year where, in general, the citizens need to pay attention to the forecast because seven of our last eight summers in our Midwest region here, we've had heat index values that have prompted the Weather Service to issue a heat advisory. So we need to pay attention to that this time of year.
All right, we're going to move on. From heat to lightning. This is Lightning Safety Week this week. It's a campaign spearheaded by the National Weather Service designed to get folks thinking about being safe when there's a storm nearby. Just last year, there were 47 confirmed deaths by lightning strikes. And, of course, you all remember we had lightning expert Ron Holley on June the 5th. If you missed that chat, check it out at minnesotapublicradio.org. And Paul Huttner, Ron, was excellent when it came to talking about the effects of lightning and just the dangers of being out there.
Yeah, he's seen a lot in his life. He's done a lot of this research for the Severe Storms Lab and other places. And, you know, 61 people a year on average are killed by lightning in the United States each year. And your odds of being struck in your lifetime, 1 in 5,000. That sounds high. It's not. Right now, an interesting thing, Kathy and Mark, I'm on the board of my local Little League here, and I've been tasked with coming up with a solution for getting the players and the families into a safe place and clearing the park when lightning is happening. And I'm looking into a lot of different options for that. It's complicated. It's not easy. But the bottom line is, people need to remember, when you hear that thunder, you got to get inside somewhere safe.
And quickly, just because I used to know this, I should remember this. You see lightning, and then you count 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, or whatever, until you hear the thunder. That means the storm center is how far away?
You divide by 5, the number of seconds, and that gives you the number of miles. So if you count to 15, you divide by 5, that lightning strike was 3 miles away from you.
That's what I want. I can never remember this. I should commit that to memory. Commit this to memory, by the way. This is the website of the week. Boy, that was pathetic. Was that a gunshot? What was that? I thought it was supposed to be thunder.
Okay. Radio.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, just that's a short thunderclap. Let's put it that way. Here's the website of the week. It's struckbylightning.org. Struckbylightning.org. Check this thing out. This offers some really good safety tips, some firsthand accounts of folks who've been hit by lightning and survived, photos, and some really interesting, if not scary, video clips of a van and a car getting hit by lightning. It's pretty amazing. Check it out, struckbylightning.org. And then our friends at the Weather Service, because it is Lightning Safety Week, they have a special website set up as well, Lightning Safety, all one word, lightningsafety.noaa.gov. So check that out too. Gentlemen, good job, by the way, this week.
Interesting program.
As always.
Thanks, Kathy. Enjoyed it as always.
Thank you, Paul and Mark. Thanks, too, for the fine production assistance by Larissa Anderson. I'm Kathy Werzer. Thank you for listening to Jet Streaming. If you have a question or comment, don't be shy. Send us something by going to the podcast section of minnesotapublicradio.org. Until next week, keep your eye on the sky.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine, high as a mountain and deep as a river, come rain or come shine.